Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to another Curzon Film Podcast, where this week we'll be going back to a time when posting your story didn't mean Snapchatting your lunch, but something arguably more important. Yes, we are back in the safe hands of our favourite uncle of cinema, Steven Spielberg, for his journalistic throwback that feels all too present. It's The Post. And two intrepid reporters joining me to break this story this week are Ryan Hewitt and Irena Musumeci. Hello to you both.
Hello.
Hello, Jake.
How are we doing?
I'm a bit ill.
Yes. Yes, and
I sound it probably, but here we are serving the story.
I spend a lot of time sitting next to Irena, so inevitably will be ill this time next week.
It's so nice to be sharing germs as well as everything else.
Sharing the germs. So we're here to talk about The Post, which is a Steven Spielberg film that didn't exist 12 months ago, and suddenly it's a nice kind of post Christmas surprise to be given a Steven Spielberg film you didn't know was happening.
He turned that around quickly in the way that only Steven Spielberg and Ridley Scott apparently can.
Yeah, and so we'll be diving right in to The Post, and it's not the only thing that we have been watching. As always, we like to catch up with each other. Ryan, over the last week, what have you been watching?
So I went to the Prince Charles Cinema this Sunday.
There are other cinemas?
There are other cinemas. There are other cinemas available, some of them very nice, but you know. I went to see Magnolia in 35mm. This was the first time that I've seen Magnolia on film. It's the first time I've seen it in the cinema. I was probably a bit too young when it first came out to see it. Doing quick sums, yeah, I was too young. I wasn't 18. Mm. But I've seen Magnolia countless times. I've lost count of how many times, but I've never seen it on the big screen. And it wasn't exactly watching it afresh, but I noticed so many things that were just lost on a small screen. So many details in the background, so much that he's filled, that Paul Thomas Anderson has filled the frame with, that just it just changed my view of certain storylines. You know, it's a magnificent film. I think it's his best film. I can't wait to see Phantom Thread in a couple of weeks' time. And it just got me all excited again for Paul Thomas Anderson. Glad to have him back.
It was I couldn't make that screening, but I joined in from a faraway distance and watched it at home on the same evening. And I have yet to see it on a big screen. And all this talk about it has got me so excited to do so. I'm hoping that this Paul Thomas Anderson tour that's been going on and Phantom Thread means maybe there'll be a few more screenings that pop up, because it's the kind of film that you do watch and immediately you can turn around and go back in and watch it again.
Yeah.
Which is exactly what I did when I saw it back in cinemas when it was released in 1999. So that dates me a bit. But also, yeah, it makes me think I really should go back and rewatch it, because I don't think I've seen it since. And I don't know why exactly, because it's a film I really loved. It felt really like a proper grown-up film by a grown-up filmmaker.
Yeah, it's an epic one.
Yeah.
And I think it's got a renewed relevance as well, certainly with the storylines relating to kind of the Tom Cruise's character, this kind of predatory male behaviour. Is like all out there and lampooned brilliantly by Tom Cruise's performance. And also this idea of, it's heavy stuff, historical sex cases, abuse cases and things like that with the game show host character. Yeah. It's all coming out and having to admit things and like,
and also like the general end of the world feeling.
Oh, the apocalypse.
Egypt, the apocalypse.
Yeah.
It's all happening.
Yeah, because a few people have been rewatching it ahead of Phantom Thread. I've read a lot of new coverage on it and new thoughts on it, which have been really nice as well. And I really like, I won't spoil it, but this idea that people were complaining maybe that the film has no point and that it's far too melodramatic. And someone on Twitter pointed out that this 3 hours and 8 minutes is worth it, and the point of it is to earn the final action of the film.
Yeah.
Which I thought was wonderful. And if you know what that is, I think is really lovely, and that is what it's all about, is earning that moment.
Yeah. Did you hear the interview in which PTA was asked, what would you do if you were making Magnolia today? And he said, I would cut 20 minutes from it.
Yeah.
There you go.
But hopefully not the last 20 minutes.
No, that is wonderful. Keep those intact.
Yeah. Arena, what have you been up to?
I was very lucky to catch a very early screening of the new film by the Russian director Andrei Zviagintsev. It's called Loveless. He was the director of Leviathan and The Return. He's a proper filmmaker. Loveless is a really interesting, also very timely film in very different ways. It talks a lot about, in very sideways ways, about the world today. It's got a big allegorical power to it. But essentially, it's the story of this couple who are arguing. They're getting divorced. It's very bitter. It's totally horrid. And the child goes missing. So it's got this kind of thriller element, but it's one of those ponderous art house films that really will last through the ages, I think. So I'm very excited. I think we'll be covering...
Yes, we will have a whole episode dedicated to this. I haven't had the chance to see it. I don't think you have yet, Ryan. No. But yes, in a few weeks, at the start of February, we'll be dedicating a whole episode to that. And brilliant. I'm sure we'll be very excited to do so. And what have I been watching, I hear you ask? So my dad has kind of hold this thing over me that he always knew that Heaven's Gate was brilliant. And that when he saw...
He did,
yeah. And he was like to point that out. When I saw it, I knew. And I'm going to throw my hat in the ring to say I've got a new one that I know in 20 years people are going to realise it is great.
I love this. Yeah,
this is Paul McGuigan's Victor Frankenstein.
Goodness me!
Yeah,
you've already grossed me out with a tweet about this.
Yes, yes, I did. Starring Daniel Radcliffe and James McAvoy. It is the Frankenstein tale told from Igor's perspective, and it is quite a remarkable feat of filmmaking.
I thought Mel Brooks's Young Frankenstein was already pretty much the story from the realistic point of view of Igor.
Yes,
very
played
by
realistic.
Martin Feldman. So I don't need another Frankenstein film.
I think you do.
I got that one.
This one is a real surprise. And I mean, going back to Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, there have certainly been some queer readings of that story, but not in the scale of this. There is some remarkable sequences in here, a particular one where James McAvoy's Frankenstein brings Daniel Radcliffe's Igor, a hunchback at this point, brings him home, and he says, I'm going to slip into something more comfortable. Comes out in this bondage gear and penetrates a bulbous ball on the back of Daniel Radcliffe's back and drains this ball of white fluid into a bucket.
And I thought that Robert De Niro and Kenneth Branagh, like, writhing in Vaseline, in a tub of Vaseline, was already, like, hitting the spot on that
one. This is going to be reread in 20 years, and I promise you, you'll be all over Victor Frankenstein, and you'll remember the day that you were in this room and you said,
"We will give you due credit when that day comes, Jake."
I think you're down in history officially as the man leading the revision that I hope never happens. But talking about Spielberg's The Post,
credit to anyone that can find a usable segue between the point I've just made and the film we will be talking about. So Steven Spielberg's The Post. Arena, you've got a sheet full of dates that are going to contextualize this film for us.
I do have a sheet full of dates. So The Post takes place, date, 1971. It's a lot of different stories wrapped into one, which is why I kind of wanted to contextualize it properly. But essentially, the core of it is the story of how the Washington Post leaked and published what's now called the Pentagon Papers, a series of documents that proved the U.S. government's implications and culpability in the Vietnam War. Now, bear with me, the story gets more exciting than that, because The Post actually focuses on the rather formidable female owner of the Washington Post at this time, Kay Graham, who was in fact the first woman ever to own a Fortune 500 listed company and was really a groundbreaking newspaper editor. Newspaper owner. Her foil in the film is Tom Hanks's Ben Bradley, who was the editor of the Washington Post at the time. And together, the two of them really embarked on this quest for the rights of the people to know the truth about their government and how the government was lying to them about the Vietnam War specifically. But then this is kind of the story that paves the way for Watergate and the demise of Nixon. So Steven Spielberg's The Post is an incredibly timely film about fake news and alternative facts and how to fight them. It's truly an ode to journalism, and I think for me one of the most interesting things is how it presents journalism as warfare from the very, very beginning of the film and kind of grounds, that lays the ground for the idea that you have to fight for the truth. So it's a pretty interesting, very timely film. There's a lot of allusions to the Trump era that are very much not veiled. I think a very hopeful kind of film at the moment.
Brian, you were there on the same night as us. We were there in the room with Spielberg.
The presence of all of those. Yeah,
and Tom Hanks.
Yeah, and Streep, everyone. And this was on the final premiere that Spielberg would do at the Odeon Leicester Square before it was refurbished. And he said that he was in that very room 41 years ago for Close Encounters. Yeah. So it felt like we're lucky enough to go to quite a few press screenings and early shows, but actually going to the event where people are there to talk about that. And you felt this romance in the room, and particularly with a film like this that is kind of Spielberg, he's clearly passionate about it as well. Like there's a romance that he has for the subject. And it felt very special to be in that room and kind of sharing that moment with them.
I completely agree, especially what you say about the romance of filmmaking. And Spielberg is, he's not the only person who really leans into that, but he is one of the rare filmmakers who just seems to be completely in awe still of cinema and the medium. And he loves it. And he is completely unabashed about how he will just the magic of cinema is what he's about, isn't it?
Yeah, well, like you mentioned earlier about Ridley Scott turning something around really quickly. I don't want to bash Ridley Scott, and I think Ridley Scott is great. But in recent interviews, when you read about his process on All the Money in the World, it doesn't read like a man who's in love with cinema.
It's very, like a workman, like
The way that he approaches it, like, I know exactly what shots I need, who needs to be there, what I need to do, and it feels like he's breaking down a film onto an Excel spreadsheet. And for him, that clearly works because he makes some great films.
Yeah.
But I don't think that's the case with Spielberg. I mentioned to you when we were talking about Bridge of Spies on Twitter that the opening shot of that, which is wonderful, was improvised on set. And you feel like Spielberg he's still got that childhood playfulness about him that he wants to just get on set, get the camera out and see what happens.
Yeah, and he wants to fit in films wherever he can, doesn't he? Like, this is sort of shot in the downtime between finishing off Ready Player One, which is some enormous scale CGI fest. That's again something that only Spielberg really could do well, I think, or hopefully. And it's reminiscent of when he went and shot Schindler's List while still finishing off Jurassic Park. And this is not a man who's just like, oh, you know, got to make the bucks, got to get another one in. It's like, oh, I've got a window.
Yeah,
I can do another one. Let me go and do another one. Yeah.
It also, I mean, it really does feel though as though he's a man on a mission. Like he wanted this film to be out now because it's so timely.
Yeah.
And the fact that he managed to get onto that quite quickly and churn it out in a way is really impressive and makes it even more timely.
Just go back to the before this film existed and the timeline of it. So this is a debut script from Liz Hanna. The rights were won by Amy Pascal of Sony in October 2016, which is not very long ago at all. Spielberg takes it in February 17. They start shooting on May the 30th last year. So that is 8-9 months ago. And now we've ended up with it, which is a phenomenal piece of work. Along the way, Josh Singer, who wrote Spotlight, which is obviously another film that is really celebrating the value of great truthful journalism, has brought in to tidy it up. And then we've ended up with this product at the end of it. And it doesn't feel scrappy. It feels polished. It doesn't feel like it's just been wrapped up.
It really doesn't. I mean, Josh Singer was also a writer on The West Wing. He sort of took over. I think he started in 2003, so it would have been around about the time when Sorkin was passing the baton on to John Wells, who was the big showrunner at that point. And I mean, writers on the West Wing know how to turn around a script pretty fast. And it's a pretty snappy kind of script. So you can definitely see his influence in that. He was brought on board to kind of create a sense of the lives of the various reporters around the two main characters, played by Meryl Streep and Tom Hanks, whereas the core of that relationship between Ben Bradley and Kay Graham already existed in the in Liz Hannah's script. And she kind of worked with the biographies about both of them separately and then kind of brought them together. And I think it's really lovely when you see two screenwriters whose work can really coexist to such a high degree, particularly because it's a male-female team, and the film is so much about this woman's journey from a place of deep insecurity to the top of this company and making this momentous decision that effectively changed journalism and really changed the course of American history. So to their credit, I think that the central partnership reflects the partnership that's at the core of the film.
Yeah, I think the two leads, that's Streep and Hanks, do a really good job in that they are maybe in advertising, or the, just because we're presented with those names, we think instantly that they're allies and they're just in the pursuit of truth. But there is actually a big kind of moral quandary at the centre of it for Meryl Streep's character, for Kay Graham, about publishing these papers, not necessarily from a financial perspective, like this is very much a personal issue for her, which is not something I knew about, that the people that she could be publishing incriminating evidence about are people that she's friends with. And that's what the film does really well, in that these are personal stories as much as they are national stories.
Absolutely, and I think that's another reason why we're seeing this story. The story is about the Post. I mean, there's a version of this story called The Times, who broke the Pentagon Papers first. But the choice to focus on the Post is because it has this rich backstory within the characters, and it has the personal difficulties in all of these decisions.
Yeah, a couple of the New York Times writers actually have brought this up, and James Goodale, who was the legal counsel at the time, said it's a good movie but bad history.
That's interesting, because in the film they mention how journalism is seen as the first rough draft of history. Yeah. I really like that phrase, but also I always think films are never a draft of history. Films are the fantasy of history. You have the power to rewrite it, to focus, to put your camera in a completely different place. And Spielberg's films in particular, all of his historical films, have this kind of boys on adventure view of history, which is both a great joy and pleasure to engage with, but also has some drawbacks for me personally in some of his political films. Munich, I have some issues with. Here it's interesting how he brings this kind of point of view of real excitement about telling the story, but also telling history through his filmmaking onto the journalists. So there's this double textual thing going on at all times.
Something that I noticed, which is it's coincidence that the two scripts have been so close together for Spielberg. We talked a few weeks ago about films that we watch on Christmas, and it turns out that my accidental Christmas tradition has become Bridge of Spies, which I watched on Christmas Day. And in a scene in this and a scene in Bridge of Spies where there is a big debate that is brought into Congress, and you have these looming white columns in front of this red background. Obviously, this is appearing as the American flag. And I love that he is creating that idea of the nation kind of forcing itself on these people, and how much that they are shouldering the weight of the belief of the country on them. And so you've got that with Tom Hanks being the lawyer having to defend the rights of a Russian spy who may or may not be a Russian spy, but it's not necessarily standing up for what the more nationalist belief would be of, we need to crush this person. It's, we need to stand up for the truth and the correct procedure. And I think that's process, the same as what we're seeing in The Post as well.
Yeah, which, I mean, The Post is very much a kind of a filmic defense of the First Amendment. And there's the passion for everything constitutional that goes across so many American pop cultural products. I mean, I'm thinking now The West Wing, which obviously I'm a big fan of, but Hamilton the musical is the same. There's all the sort of the power and ponderance of this piece of paper that defends the rights of the people. And the First Amendment is the amendment that is about the freedom of the press, but also the freedom of the people to assemble and to petition the government to change. So it's really the quintessential freedom To say, we don't like this, this needs to change. And it's almost like a rally, a call for arms. One thing that I do think is quite fascinating about the Post is how much this kind of, this sense of what America looked like at the time, it's almost like a world that's losing shape. I had this feeling throughout the film, watching people's clothes and the way they move and the way they dress and the way they inhabit spaces. I was thinking initially at the beginning of the film, I thought, oh, this is going to be like Mad Men. It's going to remind me of the kind of crisp, cool late 60s, you know, funky colors and things sort of somehow, you know, carrying on from the past. But throughout the film, there are these recurrent motifs where you're looking at, there are people looking at photographs of the past. Kay Graham's late husband, who was the owner of the Post, who subsequently, after his death, she inherited the newspaper. And it was her father who owned the newspaper initially. So in traditional patriarchal manner, the paper was passed on from the father to the father to the son-in-law, not to his daughter. And then suddenly she's the one who's having to change that course of history and takes it on after his death. So there's all this kind of sense of how the past still impinges on the present. And then there are moments when Tom Hanks as Ben Bradley is looking at pictures of himself in the company of the Kennedys, and as JFK and Jackie Kennedy, and both of them loom very large onto the film. And I kind of connected this to my memories of watching Jackie last year.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Yeah, Pablo Larraín's Jackie. And this sense of this golden world that people imagined that they were living in the Kennedy era, and how it falls apart in 63, with Kennedy's assassination. And if you remember what happens in Mad Men, everything looks really kind of quite cool and sharp to begin with, but then things start to fall apart. And really, the Post kind of picks up at this point where people have put on weight. Yeah. Their hair looks rubbish. Yeah. Their ties are kind of falling apart. Their clothes don't fit them anymore. Yeah, everyone's a little bit shabby. People are clumsy. A lot of the reporters kind of, you know, fall over themselves to reach the point where they can make the phone call, and then they drop all their change, and all this kind of stuff keeps happening. So it's almost a sense in which this place and this world is not quite the imaginary, wonderful, ideal world and the ideal America that people had in mind when this sort of promise of a golden era in the 60s was taking place. And that really does connect that sense of Vietnam being such a watershed moment for American history, which is why I wrote down all these dates, because essentially this is the story of how a newspaper revealed to the American people that the American government knew that they weren't going to win in Vietnam, and they still sent boys to die. Over 59,000 young men died in Vietnam. That's on the American side. The war lasted 20 years, and the Pentagon Papers really track down the beginning of the Vietnam War from way, way before Kennedy. And so it's just this kind of sense of the moment in which you are revealed that things aren't good and things don't look right and something must be done to change them that I think this film is very interested in.
I think it feels like there's the big splitting decision right at the middle of it for both, on both sides. You said that Tom Hanks' character is looking at his photo of him, JFK, and you've got Kay Graham, who is actually friends with Robert McNamara, played by Bruce Greenwood, and ultimately they're having to come to a decision that maybe no one's really had to face before, where they're having to split from having a kind of cordial friendly relationship with the government, because that is no longer something that they can maintain if they want to maintain that free, truthful press.
Yeah, and McNamara is he's played by actually someone who is in Mad Men. Mm. He's Richard, who is John's boyfriend in the final season of Mad Men, which is, you know, by that point everyone's overweight and not looking their best. So Bruce Greenwood appears as Robert McNamara. It's an interesting performance because he's actually quite sort of friendly, and you can see his point.
Yeah.
And what's given away the fact that actually he was a pretty nasty evil man. Yeah. He was a businessman who happened to become Secretary of Defense under Kennedy. It's his hair. I found his hair really quite creepy.
What's Willy Wonka's spy called?
I can't remember.
He's the one that's sent to go and spy on Charlie.
He's not called McNamara.
No. But he's got that look about him that he, like, whatever he says, you instantly don't trust because his hair's a bit too slick.
Yeah.
And he's all a bit too... He looks too...
Strange
party. Yeah, the suit hangs a bit too loose. He looks like he's a bit skeletal underneath it. So he's definitely untrustworthy from the first moment.
Yeah, and the film begins with him lying openly to the press. So he's on the plane. He's asking, can we win the war? No is the answer. He goes out to the press. They go, Mr. McNamara, can we win this war? Yes. So, you know, from the beginning that it's the lies that we need to fight.
Yeah. And that's Bruce Greenwood, who is one in an astonishing cast. We have a list in front of us here. We've got Michael Stuhlbarg, who's got the best ratio of potential starring in Best Picture nominees ever. You've got David Cross of Arrested Development, who was unrecognisable. And it took me a few scenes and it was like, oh, that is Dr. Tobias Funke from Arrested Development. And as you said, everyone's a bit overweight and everyone's hair is terrible and everyone's beard is a bit mangled and looks like they've got a pizza stain down their shirt or something. And David Cross very much emphasises that. But Jesse Plemons, Carrie Coon, Alison Brie, Bradley Whitford, Tracy Letts, Bob Odenkirk, Sarah Paulson, Tom Hanks and Meryl Streep. It's
and
pretty
Sasha Spielberg, Stephen's daughter.
Playing.
Oh, bit of a spoiler. Don't know if I can say it. She plays a hippie-looking woman.
Oh, okay. Right. Gotcha.
Yeah. Well, we can't talk about all of those performances, so let's break it down to the big ones. Meryl Streep and Tom Hanks. Surprisingly, in a shocking move, they're good. Ryan, you've got the scoop.
I think Meryl Streep in particular owns this. I think Tom Hanks, I love Tom Hanks to pieces. He's got a slightly peculiar accent in this one that did take me a little while to get used to, but he's great and they're great together. And in particularly in the first couple of scenes, or their first two scenes together, I was reminded of His Girl Friday quite a bit, partly because of this newspaper setting, partly because of the way it's been written with this machine gun kind of dialogue where particularly, they both seem to know what the other one's going to say and they've already got their reply ready made. And it's got this really fun back and forth between them, and the two of them just work brilliantly together. It's kind of hard to believe that they've never been on screen together before.
Yeah. Well, it doesn't feel like it at all.
Yeah.
They just jump right in. And it's almost like a two sitcom characters that are just entering season 12 or something. And they're just so used to it at this point.
Yeah.
And that she's the kind of cranky boss and he just wants to be let him do his own thing. Like maybe he's like the renegade cop and she's the boss.
Yeah.
And that's the dynamic, but they play it really well.
It also changes the relationship between them as she gains more and more confidence in what she's doing, which is, I know we've talked about this together in private, and that's kind of the part of the film where I find myself really questioning a little bit of the journey of this character, Kay Graham, who is obviously played stunningly by Meryl Streep, and I've subsequently changed my mind again about her. So initially I was thinking, oh God, we have to see a woman being so like awkward and clumsy and lacking confidence. And, you know, everything in the initial scenes, she's always kind of walking into these rooms where they reveal, you know, the door opens and it's full of looming elderly white males and she's the only woman there. And so, yes, I get it. It's a woman in a men's world. And I was a bit suspicious of that because I wanted to see where we were going to be taken with this narrative, you know, in that I think there's a lot of discussion about empowering roles for women, and I essentially don't need to see Meryl Streep being clumsy to believe that she's powerful. And she's going to get to a point where she's powerful. But apparently that's located in quite a lot of authentic recordings and memoirs about Kay Graham. She was physically quite clumsy and kind of always sort of falling around and had a great lack of confidence. And then I realized I was being very harsh on this trope in the film, because what I wanted to see was the kind of, yes, confident woman mm-hmm. takes over. Yes, she's the boss. But actually, this film is not operating like that at all. It's sort of observing this idea of the woman in a men's world at a time when so many women found ways to be very powerful and very resilient in roles that were very traditional. Another cast member, so Alison Brie, appears as Kay Graham's daughter. Now, she plays a fantastic character in Mad Men, Trudy Campbell, who was married to Pete. And she's a totally conventional, sort of quite posh, wealthy, definitely, woman who all she wants to do is stay at home and raise babies. But she wants to be treated well, and she wants a decent life for the kids. And she is actually an incredibly strong character, yeah. even within the realms of that role. Mm-hmm. And actually thinking about Alison Brie being in this film made me rethink the way I saw Meryl Streep's performance, and really made me think about what happens to Kay Graham as a character. Once she makes the decision to go through with it, to publish, send to press.
Just to point out, that's not a spoiler. If you're going into this film wondering whether or not they post,
that is
history. They do.
History. I think she has a fascinating arc, and I did actually then discovered some heightened empathy in myself as a woman, thinking about that place of feeling, lacking confidence in the moment when you're actually having to raise your voice and you're actually having to make the decision in front of a group of men. So I'm sort of umming and erring on the woman's angle, but I do fall on the side of, actually, Stephen, thank you. This is not, the greatest thing that you can do for women, but it's a good start. It's a good film.
I think you were going to touch on it there, that when she does decide to print it, her speech in that moment is not polished. That it's not what maybe someone would call it, like a Spielberg moment, where someone suddenly decides that they're going to do the proactive thing and they're going to do the thing that's right and they're going to say it perfectly. And you've got Meryl Streep and everyone in the room, and we as viewers, because we know Meryl Streep and we know this type of film, we're expecting her to then go, let's do it, or something like that. But she completely fumbles her words.
Yeah. and she said...
Let's run it. Let's do it.
And I am going to bed.
Yeah.
That's the next thing she said. Because absolutely, it's the middle of the night and I'm a woman. I'm going to go. Leave me alone.
Yeah. That's actually a middle of a five-way phone conversation, which is a really well done scene, which must have been a nightmare to film and edit. But congratulations to him, because it's a really lovely scene.
There's so much of that from Spielberg. So many well-orchestrated scenes of... Yeah, this is a lot of film. There's a lot of people sitting in rooms on sofas around tables just talking. But the camera has got so much energy and it creates so much movement in the rooms. And there's almost moments when it feels a little bit theatrical and pantomime. There's a particular Steadicam shot in the Bradley house where people move in and out of frames. They're having arguments. Mm. Lawyers are arguing with journalists. And it's all so perfectly timed that it's hyper real and it, but it just has the Spielberg magic to it. And it's so aware of what it is. Yeah. And there's a wonderful moment, or I think it's a wonderful moment near the beginning, that harks back to your point about the boy's own influence, where we see the guy, this is in the first 5 minutes, it's not a spoiler. You see the guy in a dark room, dark office, and there's a filing cabinet and he opens it with a torch and he finds the papers and they look important. And then Spielberg saying, you see these papers, they look serious, don't they? Just take a look down at the bottom here. It says top secret on the papers, just in case we didn't know. This is it. This is the thing. And it's so just unashamedly playing that kind of that Tintin influence and that even little bits of Indiana Jones, I suppose.
It's that spirit of adventure.
Yeah.
And it's putting the adventure in this quite a dull environment. It's actually really encouraging. And you hope that, like, this is there might be quite a bit of dialogue for kids to get it, but to give kids or younger people that adventure platform, but yeah. in an office yeah. environment, would actually be really encouraging to think, wow, it's just as cool to write things as it is to go and find
a treasure.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, Tintin is a journalist, so that's course, his yeah. job, he's yeah, a reporter. Yeah. yeah, there's a lovely moment in the film that happens twice. It's a nice little gag that really reminded me of Tintin. There are two interns, one's in the New York Times and one's at the Washington Post, and the Times intern gets sent to do something, and he runs out of the building, and you're following him on the camera, and he runs so fast across the road that this taxi car nearly hits him and kind of stops in front of him and brakes really hard, yeah. and he's going, "Oh, okay, sorry." And then, you know, half an hour later, the Washington Post intern is another kid in his 20s, gets sent to do the same thing across from Washington to New York. And as he's crossing to go into the doors of the New York Times, again, he's doing it so fast yeah. that the car just kind of breaks in front of it. And it's a really nice little gag. But absolutely, the reference to Indiana Jones, I think the ending of this film is Raiders of the Lost Ark, 100%.
Yeah. and that final shot of the film takes place in the press where the Washington Post is made. And this draws me into some of my favourite sequences in the film, which are the letterpress sequences, which I absolutely love. And I think people listening might know that Tom Hanks is an enormous fan of typewriters, and he absolutely loves them. And he's even guested on a podcast. After he said no, they sent him a typewriter, a really nice one. And he sent a reply back written on the typewriter saying, it was like on the lines of, "You think I'll go on your podcast just because you sent me this this wonderful vintage typewriter? Oh, fine, I'll come on." And there are these lovely montages where they are setting up the old letterpress and building the words and building the characters and making the paragraphs. And you see the front sheet on the day of the press as it's made out of metal. And you forget that that's how it's actually made. And it gives this physicality to journalism that we're really losing now. Like, this film wouldn't have the impact when someone post something on, I don't know, online. Something like Snowden probably has that issue because it's just people sitting in a room on a laptop. It's not as interesting if people can hammer something and you're really, it's like a blacksmith building the champion's sword and handing it over to him as it's kind of still glowing with fire.
Yeah.
It's like that's the feeling that we're getting as these presses are being made.
There's a real physical way in which the news kind of travels from person to person, even to the point where this person walks into the office and dumps a box in front of a reporter and says, "Are you important?" He says, "Yeah." And this box is full of the papers. And then the papers have to be taken, you know, physically from one person to the next. There's no like attachment to an email or anything. And then you see the first draft being handed from one person to the other. Mm. And there's one kid whose job it is to run around the office and be the physical runner. And a lot about sort of the physical act of carrying the news, which it's really nice and nicely done. But it's a beautiful sort of analog kind of world. The coin operator telephones, I love. I miss those so much.
But again, on that point that you've both made, there is something about the permanence of what's being written there. There's like a romance to that era of we've had to forge these words in whatever kind of metal they use for the presses, and then it's on a truck, and we see the journey, and we see the guy throwing the papers out the back of a truck into the street for the newsstands, and that's it. Like, what we've written is now what's out there. Mm-hmm. There's no option to go in and write a little update. This article has been updated since we were made aware of something we got wrong. Like, it's done, it's written now. There's a permanence to it, which I think is really relished in that process.
Although it's interesting because we didn't really discuss this openly in terms of the difference between analog and online journalism, but we can see recently that so much online journalism is having a major impact in so many things. And I think, you know, obviously I'm thinking right now of the Weinstein story because it's so ongoing and relevant, and it was a piece in the New Yorker online first and then on the printed edition, which broke really that cycle of silence. But also, there's a lot of parallels here with these stories of Snowden, who we mentioned, of Chelsea Manning, you know, people who were involved in the first person in various stories and managed somehow to find a way to leak them and bring them out. So it's really a sense of, you know, it's a film that tries to speak to both the world of its era and is very maybe nostalgic about her, but also tries to say something about the world today and saying that there's a heroism in doing this, which is not evident at all times. Chelsea Manning announced last week that she's going to run for office in Maryland, and I'm sure she's getting tons of abuse, and she's still considered a traitor and someone, you know, she served a sentence for basically betraying the state and giving away secrets to the enemy, which is the treason charge that all of the characters in this film are facing, the New York Times and the Washington Post. And it's the charge that Kay Graham could have brought on to herself, to Ben Bradlee, to all the staff members of the Washington Post and everybody involved. So the decision is really portentous and really significant. And it's high-stake game. It's got high casualties, especially at a time when the United States were at war in a very overt way. Vietnam's still ongoing in 1971. The draft is still going. And so this idea that you are the person who's leaking the secrets to the enemy, or, you know, being a traitor to the state, is a very significant one in terms of public opinion.
Well, on that point, I think that that definitely covers a lot of our thoughts on The Post. Do go out and watch it in cinemas whilst you can, because it is a really, really wonderful film. But it's not actually the only film about American politics that's out this week, is it?
That's surprising, because American politics is so dull. Nothing happens these days.
No, it's never in the news, is it? No. I often wonder, I go onto Twitter and I think, God, I wish people would tell me what the president of America's up to.
What's he thinking this morning?
Yeah, because you just don't see it anymore. Right, but there is actually a film about the American president, the former one, Barack Obama, called The Final Year, which is going to be in a few select cinemas and on Curzon Home Cinema. So if you cannot make it to one of the cinemas where it's playing, you can watch that. It's a documentary all about, you might have guessed it, the final year of Obama's office. Sam Howlett, another of our intrepid reporters, who is unable to join us this evening, as I'm sure he's breaking an important story somewhere else. He has seen The Final Year and can confirm it is excellent. And I look forward to watching it myself from Friday when it is out. But that's not the only thing on Curzon Home Cinema. Just this week, we added Borg McEnroe, which came out last year. We did an interview with Stellan Skarsgård, and you can now watch that on Curzon Home Cinema too. So if you did miss that, then do go and check it out too. If you've got any thoughts on The Post and you have seen it and you've listened to us talk about it, do send us an email at podcast@curzon.com, as we would love to read your thoughts out. And review us on iTunes. You can subscribe, leave a review, leave a comment, rate us out 5 stars. Do any and all of those, because they do help us build an audience and get more listens and hopefully give you more lovely podcasts to listen to. But I think that must be the end of our show. And it's time to close the presses and say goodbye for this week. It's goodbye from Ryan.
Goodbye.
Goodbye from Miranda.
Goodbye
from me.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.